Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. An immediate ceasefire is needed in Syria to prevent the spread of COVID-19, top UN negotiator for Syria, Geir Pedersen, said on Tuesday in a recording made on his laptop computer to respect social distancing restrictions relating to the virus. Mr. Pedersen said that Syrians are acutely vulnerable to COVID-19.
Healthcare facilities have been destroyed or are degraded. There is a shortage of key medical equipment and health professionals. Internally displaced persons and refugees, as well as detainees and abductees, are living in conditions that are especially dangerous. I have real concerns for the impact on Syrian women, who are already at the forefront of existing health and community support systems. This common threat knows no boundaries. It does not discriminate. It does not care whether you live in areas controlled by the Syrian government or other areas. It endangers all Syrians.
The UN envoy's statement follows UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres' appeal on Monday for a global ceasefire in a bid to focus on a common enemy, the new coronavirus. The UN envoy also reiterated his willingness to work with all warring parties to ensure that the truce holds, while also appealing for the large-scale release of detainees and abductees and immediate access for humanitarian organizations to all detention facilities. The development comes as the World Health Organization reported more than 335,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 14,500 fatalities. Staying with the virus, UN transport experts have warned that uncoordinated border control measures taken to stop transmission risks causing huge delays in delivering vital food, medicine and fuel to many countries. John Rodriguez from the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe, or UNECE, said that the patchwork of measures is making it increasingly difficult to keep road transport supply chains open.
What we're seeing is that a huge amount of countries have imposed transport restrictions both for passengers and for goods over the last weeks. And well, some of those are perfectly understandable in order to protect the population and to limit the spread of the virus. What we're saying is that they should be limited to the maximum extent possible to allow for the normal flow of goods, especially for goods which are absolutely indispensable, like food and medical supplies.
To help transport operators and help keep supply chains working as smoothly as possible, UNECE has launched an online COVID-19 border crossings observatory. It provides up-to-date information on border crossing restrictions worldwide in conjunction with national customs focal points, the International Road Transport Union, the transport sector and the European Commission. Finally, to Geneva, where the head of the UN there has called for greater international cooperation to combat the coronavirus threat. Speaking from the Palais des Nations in the Swiss city, Tatiana Valavaya insisted that the pandemic had shown us that without global togetherness, we cannot fight coronavirus or any other global challenges. Mrs. Valavaya also said that COVID-19 was even more urgent than the climate crisis.
It shows that what can happen not in 5 years or 10 years, but tomorrow, if we are not working together. I think one of the lessons of all the crisis is that we do have multilateral institutions, but sometimes we do not provide them with enough possibility to find the response. And I think that's exactly the lesson of this situation as well. We have to listen more to our multilateral institutions. We have to have more multilateral response, because national responses, unfortunately, in this global world are no longer effective.
Responding to concerns that self-interest and xenophobia have characterized the response of some countries to the pandemic, the senior UN official insisted that key UN values mattered most, not least respect for human rights, solidarity, and fighting nationalism and populism. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Now, if I asked you to do some great heroic thing to save someone's life, like splash through the ice and take out a drowning child from the lake, a lot of you would do that. And you have that opportunity today. Today you can save a life. And for a lot of us, all we have to do is stay at home. No great hard thing.
Dr. John Campbell, coronavirus. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
So here we are. The greatest pandemic in 100 years is upon us. An unstable economy has crashed. Major cities and whole countries are on lockdown. All we know is disintegrating daily, hourly. Those who survive will speak of before and after 2020. Our time together right now is rushed and precious. I will not pretend to be a medical expert, although I do talk with them. My interview with Britain's Dr. John Campbell on the coronavirus was heavily downloaded. It's still available free from our website. I have researched and studied climate change for years, and we may get a slap of extreme heat coming as skies clear above every industrial country. But I have just one message for you now. It is not too late to prepare to feed yourself in the coming times of trouble for those you love and maybe even for your community. We need to produce local food and food in your yard or balcony right now. Buy seeds. I will explain basic steps and possibilities in these whirlwind of days. Then we go to my classic interview with the urban homesteader, the original urban homesteader, Jules Dervais. We'll have selections from my chat with Marjorie Wildcraft, the founder of Grow Your Own Groceries. And if we have time, maybe a few minutes with psychologist Kathy McMahon dealing with stress during an emergency. But first, let's try to understand the four phases of food stress that I expect. These stages are based on early medical studies of how COVID-19, as the disease is officially called, how it works. For your comfort and survival, timing is everything. You need to know when the risk is very, very high, when you might get sick, how long sickness and the quarantine may last, when government experts expect another wave of illness. We urgently need to know short-term priorities, but also the prognosis for the food supply next winter. If we grasp the timetable of possibilities, we have a better chance. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining me again on Radio EcoShock. By the way, the 100 nonprofit radio stations carrying this program every week are also under pressure from this disease. Resonance FM in London asks hosts to create their programs from home. Well, I've been doing that for 14 years. All stations are posting stringent safety precautions and cleaning studio equipment. It's hard to travel to some of our studios. It is possible some stations may close down during the emergency. If you do not hear Radio EcoShock in our regular time slot, please go to my website at ecoshock.org. You can listen to the latest program, posted every Wednesday afternoon Pacific time, or you can download it, all for free, of course. I plan to stay online and on the air producing, unless the virus gets to me too. So, what are these stages of food? You are probably living the first stage right now, or you will be soon. In some parts of North America and the world, you can still shop for advanced supplies before the big wave of sickness, hospitalization, and deaths arrive. No matter what the government says, you should do that. Forget about toilet paper. You can wipe your butt and wash that hand as a few billion humans do every day. So the first stage is immediate food, let's say for 2 weeks. Millions of people have moved from home cooking to restaurant meals and frozen dinners. Cooking with what you have is almost a lost art. You may need to start watching YouTube if you can. Look at those videos. Learn how to cook again or to cook with whatever you can find in your cupboards. In fact, I recommend you do what I do. Set aside at least an hour a day, perhaps in the evening, to learn about food, growing it, storing it, and preparing healthy meals. If you are quarantined at home with your family, let everybody watch and talk about it and do it. News, I know, is coming in so fast, you can sit in front of the TV, computer, or phone with every free hour, but you cannot eat the news. So please, turn aside for a while, go online and learn what grows best, what stores best, what tastes best in the region where you live. Long-term health is not the goal of real-time emergency food. You need enough to carry you and yours for a couple of weeks. Do that. First step. I know that too many people were already short of food and money even before this corona crisis began. Others have way too much of the worst kinds of fats and sugars, leading to obesity in over a third of Americans and high rates of weight problems around the world. And this is a co-problem if you get COVID-19. It makes it much more risky for you. So I guess part of stage one is to remember, like cats and dogs and other mammals, humans can live up to a month without any food at all, depending on the state that you start in. People willfully fast that long, and they live. Sometimes they come out better than when they began. So don't panic about the first few weeks of stage one, but do get some food if you can. Stage two is the extreme crisis food. And extreme food stress can come to a city, a country, or to you personally very quickly. It begins with the perception that there may not be enough food soon or in the near future. That perception alone has led to revolutions in many countries in other times. Strangely, a single city might lose its food connections as it becomes a hot spot. Truckers don't want to go there. They get shunned and quarantined if they do. Most food is brought into cities by truck these days, with a smaller amount arriving daily by ship or train. Yes, the trains and ships bring in bulk grains and big loads, but the real link to your supermarket is by truck. The other food crisis could come if you get serious symptoms of COVID-19. You have the disease. After 5 or 6 days, when you may not even know you have the virus, you most likely would develop a fever. The body, as designed by nature, does not usually want to eat then. The old expression is, feed a cold, starve a fever. It seems that you would probably have to look after yourself. Even if you have a spouse or family, it is best not to expose them if you can avoid it. You go into a room by yourself, yet you will be more tired than at any time in your entire life. That is when you need to have prepared meals suitable for illness. Water and liquids with electrolytes come first. Dehydration can lead directly to death. Electrolytes begin with simple salt, a good dose of salt. Make sure you have salt in your home. Calcium, magnesium, and potassium are also important, and they can be taken as supplements if you can afford them. Make sure you have those mineral supplements on hand for everyone in your household if it's possible. Another way is to drink those foul-tasting sports drinks like Gatorade. Athletes drink them to keep their electrolytes up during stressful exercise. Hospitals drip electrolytes into your system through those bags. If the hospital is overloaded and dangerous, you may need your own electrolytes during your illness. Then we have very easy-to-digest foods like soups. If you do not know how to cook, or your time to buy anything is really short, canned soup will do. Campbell's Soup has added extra shifts trying to keep up with demand. Read the labels, but this is one time when salty soups are okay. For listeners already stuck in quarantine or complete lockdown, the stage 2 food crisis should still be manageable in most countries. I see that in northern Italy, where the novel coronavirus has been horrible, just horrible, the food stores are still well stocked. People are allowed out to food shop as they were in Wuhan City, China, when the peak of their outbreak struck. Most industrial countries already have a surplus of food when this disease struck in the winter of 2019-2020. I don't expect famine in the next few months. I really don't. However, access to food may be tricky or irregular, especially outside major cities. Historically, the big cities emerge as local rulers during a pandemic or other crisis. When Soviet Moscow was starving in 1932 or 1933, the army sent trucks out from the city to plunder any food they could find in the countryside. They went to the breadbasket, the Ukraine, and they took all the grain, even the seed stock. With nothing left to eat and no seeds to plant, Ukrainians starved by the millions. It is called the Holodomor. Look it up. I don't expect anything like that. Not this year. But our local village food store was almost wiped clean on Monday, March 16th, with strangers driving over an hour to find food in rural places. They came from the cities. payment machine stalled or went down under a heavy load across Canada. American food shelves were wiped clean the same day. Then our supply truck for the local supermarket did not come. They did not have food to restock. Now it is a bit better, but that is a reminder. Food workers, and particularly checkout people, are frontline first responders now. Treat them with care and respect and don't show up if you're sick at all. And stand back and don't breathe on these important people. With just a few cases of the virus, that food store may close down for a while. Can we count on anything, really? During periods of panic buying, most aware folks steer for very different products. We don't care about toilet paper. We look for rice, of course. But bags of potatoes, onions, and canned goods, they can keep. Because it's this stage 2 crisis, most of us realize we may not feel safe to go out again for a while. For how long? Try to picture what you might eat for 3 months. That seems like a reasonable guess. Even the denier-in-chief in Washington has said this outbreak could go into July or August in the United States. It looks like the Italy-level peak of hospital overload will hit North America and likely Europe in the middle of May to the middle of June. You may not want to go out then. You may not feel well enough to go out then. You may not be allowed to go out then. So what you can get in basic foods now should keep you going for about 3 months. I know that's tough. In fact, that's an impossible order for those folks who had little food in the house before this crisis arrived. I know some listeners don't have enough money to get 3 months' worth of food. We are talking about food to survive this crisis, not to duplicate a former diet that just made us fat. We need flour, and most of us need to watch videos to learn how to bake it into bread. Don't forget you will need yeast, which is cheap enough and still available. Give us this day our daily bread, or veggies, if you are off the bread. Again, our ideas of what to eat might have to change. A keto diet doesn't make much sense if bread is all you have. Vegetarians might have to accept a meat soup if that is all the government offers. Think about it. The 114,000 kids who depend on New York schools for food, many of them homeless, do not have a lot of options for diet or for stocking up. We should have stocked up for them and set up a safety net, but we did not in America. It's a bit better in other countries. During previous famines in history, Western-style governments did provide basic food one way or another. There were soup kitchens and bread lines. During the 1930s Depression, my mother-in-law's family in Manitoba, Canada, got a big bag of wheat left on their doorstep every month. Wheat was what they had a lot of on the prairies. Eventually, your government may provide some food if you live in large cities. I hope charities and communities will rally to provide food for those who need it, even though that is so much harder by our inability to gather in any groups. We can't have bread lines unless people can stand many feet or meters apart. Collecting and organizing food is harder during a pandemic, but it likely will happen, at least for the first year. We have all sorts of greens planted in trays here at our home, sitting in south-facing windows. Anybody can do that for less than $20 if you have windows with sun. Use old containers or cans. Add some green to your days. It can even help your mental health to see that green growing. On to stage 3, which I call the pause. Studies and reports I review suggest we may see a pause in the number of new cases by August in the Northern Hemisphere. Hotter, drier weather might help, so the hope goes, despite signs of COVID-19 in hot, dry places like Saudi Arabia and hot, humid places like Singapore. But experts in epidemiology, those who track diseases, also suggest this infection might reach a peak before summer. Then there would be many survivors, millions and millions of people who lived despite this illness. That creates a partial wall of immunity, which could slow down the spread. Wuhan, China, is experiencing something like this pause now in the middle of March, just after 2 months when the main wave of sickness struck. But the latest studies suggest that relief may not be the end, it could just be a pause. Specifically, a study coming from 30 scientists led by Imperial College London, shows a second big wave of infection and illness rising in October. In fact, their study suggests that the success of flattening the curve of infection now actually increases the probability of more waves of infection later. For example, their study showed closing schools and shutting down cities protects a lot of people, so it saves lives in an overloaded hospital system. But it also leaves more people with no immunity, so when the weather is most favorable to the virus, it comes back in a second wave. We don't know. That could mean factories and business will try to restart late this summer, and we need them. People will feel reassured and come out. They will need to come out, to visit one another, to hold funerals and arrange things, to hold weddings. That passes the remains of the virus around again. This disease can slink around unseen with just a few cases reported for a month or more before exploding exponentially again. You may need to use any pause or looser restrictions on your movement as a time for dedicated preparation for a long and difficult winter to come. Maybe the experts are wrong, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe a vaccine will be found and shot into millions or billions of arms before winter. Maybe the virus will mutate and die away. Or maybe you need to start thinking about long-term food, at least a year's worth, as soon as you get through the short-term stage 2 crisis. So, stage 4. I will tell you what I am doing this evening. Our onions are drying in the greenhouse, 50 pounds of onions in a 9-drawer food dryer. I have to do like 3 or 4 rounds to get 50 pounds done. This round will need overnight. I'll check them in the morning. We did not want the house to reek of onions all night, so they're outside in a shed. 50 pounds fills about 5 1-quart or 1-liter jars. Onions are mostly water, they dry down nicely, and all the flavor is there for soups or stews. Dried onions packed in canning jars in a cool, dark place should keep up to 2 years. The raw onions in a bag would not have lasted 2 months. We would have had no onions even during stage 2. And I'm now about to tell you something that points you to buying canning jars, if you can. Just 1 hour ago, we realized our second emergency freezer, a small old ice cream freezer we got for free and used for years when we lived in a Vancouver condo, it stopped working. It was full of frozen vegetables, again, to take us through at least until we get garden veggies in a few months. So I hauled out a giant stock pot, poured all the veggies in with some stock and corn, carrots, and more onions, and I estimate we will get about 12 1-quart bottles of veggies in broth, or about 12 liters. The irony is, I expected this freezer failure to come, but I expected with a warning that all the power was out. Nope, just equipment failure. Luckily, we caught it just in time, as most veggies were still frozen but defrosting. By the way, those were the last frozen veggies seen at our local store. As I said, the supply truck never came. That is minor compared to the shocking news every night, and tonight especially. Disease is raging through Italy and all Europe. It is ramping up in the United States with thousands of new cases every day. It's a crippling blow to the economy right now, with a wave of deaths approaching in as little as a week or two. Millions of Americans are now unemployed, suddenly, overnight. And compared to Europe, Canada, or Australia, the harsh American system is hard to grasp. Millions of people do not have medical care. There are millions in prisons with no thought of releasing nonviolent offenders before the plague strikes them, defenseless, in their cells. It's inhuman. Even Iran, thought to be repressive, released over 50,000 people from prisons as they saw the onslaught of COVID-19 coming. The clock is ticking in America for the prison system and for the homeless. Millions will die if the government and the people cannot come together to battle this down right now in time. As I see it, a mere depression like the 1930s now looks like the best-case scenario. The global economy is shutting down, and we were too careless to build another. all the calls for localism, including on this station, failed. So the long term for many of us is big governments cannot save us, and perhaps cannot save themselves. In a further irony, the mayor of Chicago just released his book about the growing power of cities in a phase of weakness in the central government. Any student of history can hear the shadows of city-states and feudalism trying to return. Last week, I urged listeners to rip out their lawns and plant food. Even apartments and condo owners have some green space that could be growing food. There are spaces beside the sidewalk between that and the road. Grow food. Where there were victory gardens everywhere during World War II, we now need survival gardens. We have the timing of seasons on our side. If you and your community start now, in the Northern Hemisphere at least, a mass spring planting is still possible. Havana, Cuba did it when their Russian support dried up along with any oil supplies. They mobilized to feed themselves. We must do the same. But this time, we could use social media to organize, but we cannot plan to work directly together. We have to work in shifts where we maintain a safe distance apart. It's so strange. No human has ever had to do this before, except perhaps during the Black Death in the middle 1300s. At least this time we know what the disease is and how it spreads. They did not know any of that. When masses of people died, the whole social order changed. Cities in the Middle Ages, as Foucault documented, created the great modern order of authority. Part of the way cities operate was dictated by the need to survive disease. Our future, and most people, will survive into a new future. Remember that. Our future will be vastly different than the past. But for you to get there, you need access to food, water, and shelter, as you know. My role here today is to pass on a few tips about how to grow that food. Next week, I hope to bring you my interview with one of the creators of Modern Victory Gardens. But who knows what will happen next week? The long term in my four-stage vision is really not very long term. The goal in the fourth stage is to survive until the summer of 2021. In that summer, we can again get more vegetables from local growers. And by then, I believe, a vaccine will be available and distributed widely enough to form a safety curtain around this new disease, and the survivors with immunity will build again. That's the hope, and any plan has to include hope. Or why try at all? Our first interview is with Jules Gervais, more or less the founder of the new urban homesteading movement. And most of you live in cities, so this is for you. The Gervais family managed to feed themselves entirely on a simple city lot. But I chose this interview from 2011 because I think we need this now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the 1980s, when I was hacking away brush on a 200-acre homestead in Wayback Country, Jules Gervais and his family stayed home. They turned a city lot in Pasadena, California, into a food-producing mini-farm with a philosophy that anyone can do it. The Gervais family have defined a new way of sustainable city living. Jules Gervais, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So, how is the harvest this year?
Okay, well, I say it's up and down. We're experiencing shocks this year that we've kind of never had before. So it's a new experience for us. We thought we had our act together. That's always the optimism in me, but we've seen quite a bit of problems. There's been of course, the weather gyrations, but we've had more than our share of downs. This looks like it'll be a down year. We have up and downs for the last 10 years, but this one will be when it gets to the end, when we tally the produce. January 1st, it'll probably be one of our lower years.
And how much do you normally produce in a year, just to give our listeners an idea?
Okay, well, we started out with 2,300 pounds back in 2001, and our highest we got was in 2010 was 7,000 pounds of fruits and vegetables on a tenth of an acre garden. And in between, it's been all over the place. But this, what bothers me now is we should be getting better, and yet we can't really control the weather. So it's like it's new to us what nature throws at us.
It's terrible here in British Columbia. The spring was just so late and so wet and so cold. A lot of people are complaining they just couldn't get their crops to fruit properly and other problems.
That's correct. I mean, we're the same thing here, except in the other way. We got too dry. Everything that we have is almost extreme. So they call it global weirding instead of global warming. It's you get it all around the country, all around the world, is that there's no one mean temperature or low or high where you can average it out. It's way spiking all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least we're not in Texas where they don't get any rain at all.
Yeah, they really spike in bad there. I mean, with the wildfires now, they're paying for years of drought. With on top of that, they get fire. Yeah.
Well, you're still talking about a lot of food this year. What do you do with it all?
Well, we started out trying to feed our family. Myself and my three adult children here, we've been working on feeding ourselves, but we did pretty well, and we're in the city, so this in Southern California, they have a lot of these trendy restaurants, so we were able to convert some of our surplus vegetables and produce into cash, so we can buy stuff that we can't grow on the farm here. So there's a little bit of a side business. It's when it's up and down like this to this year, the side business has to suffer, but we still feed ourselves, you know. That's what the blessing is.
Yes, indeed. Well, I want to get back to the sort of big picture of what this all means, but can we start with a few tips? There are people out there who want to do what you're doing. Let's start with the basics, which is soil. How should we prepare city soil and make it so it's productive year after year?
Right. Well, that's a good question, and it depends on what soil you start with. We started with sort of an adobe-type soil that became hard as a rock when the sun would bake it. And so we had to amend it a lot. We started composting almost 25 years ago when I bought the property. We wouldn't throw away any of our waste, especially our kitchen waste. We would bury it, and it came home that the soil got better. Some places are better than others, but in the city, you know, you have to take, you can't do too much. You're stuck with what you have. And so we've basically composted everything that we could ever get our hands on. And so much as we brought in wood chips from the outside, and people throw away straw hay bales that they use for decoration around Halloween and Thanksgiving. We go and collect that, and we add to the soil. Now, you can purchase organic mixes now, which we didn't have to have available a couple of years back, but now they're available at nursery centers if you get the organic compost.
And some people, they're just renting, so they don't have a lot of choices, and they've got big asphalt driveways and paved patios. Can they still use that space?
Well, yeah, that's what we have that too. That's what we started out with. We had a big 40-foot by 40-foot slab in the backyard. They used it as a business. He had a trucking business, so the person we bought the house from. And we stuck with a lot of concrete, a lot of places that are small. We turned to container gardening, and they have a new container gardening's situation now where they have self-watering pots and self-watering boxes. And so you can start a little mini garden on decks, on patios, and on concrete areas. And you can definitely get some salads and some, these tomatoes and stuff that is, you know, very good for homegrown produce. You know, you can get that right away without the land. Now, if you're fortunate enough to have some land, even along the fence line, you can grow beans, pole beans, and squash along the fence line. So you've got to use all available space, but definitely look into containers.
And it must take a lot of water to grow so much, especially in Southern California. Can you give us any tips about your water management?
Yes, the watering situation here is a challenge, always will be, looks like, until we get enough rain. But one of the things we do is we plant closer together than you see out in the fields. The field spacing, when they normally give you the spacing in the books, how far apart to space the plants, that's basically for tractors and running equipment down the rows. We plant closer together, so we hope to have the leaves touch to form a canopy, which would then shade the ground below it and create a microclimate so that there's some cooler and damper weather below the surface. And we're trying to do what they call a food forest. So you want to get as close as you can without getting too much, too damp. And so it's a lot of experimentation. But what we do is water in the mornings or in the evenings so that there's no evaporation. and we hand water, and we also use what they call ollas. I don't know if you've seen that on our website.
No, I haven't seen it.
But they're old. They're clay. There's an old form of drip irrigation, about 2,000 to 3,000 years old, that they plant a unglazed clay pot in the ground, and they fill it with water, and it seeps out as needed. So it saves overhead watering. It goes right to the drip zone of the plant underneath in the root zone, and it's underneath the plant real close by, so it just feeds that plant, so you don't have many weeding problems too. So it's a good form. We're heavy into conservation of water since we don't have much. Now other people, they obviously have the opposite problem. They have too much water, so it's always a challenge.
Oh, this is good stuff. You are listening to Jules Dervais on Radio EcoShock. With his three adult children, the Dervais family raises inspiring amounts of food right in the city, and this could be the way we feed ourselves in the future, I think. What is the value of doing this for people? It's got to be bigger than just feeding yourself, as important as that is.
Right. Well, it began that personal need to take care of your own needs and getting your food directly, instead of going through all the middlemen and who's your farmer and where is your farmer and how are they farming. This was an empowerment process of taking back this in our own hands, which we lost over the centuries. But it's gone more than that, because what we've done is change our lifestyle from city people disconnected from nature. And now, I mean, we are so in touch with nature. We're watching nature all the time. when it's like your future is bound up with our connection with nature. So you have to take care of a lot of things that you never thought you'd let somebody else take care of. You let maybe the experts take care of. And now it's become myself and my children's lifestyle to just change the way we live and how we can survive for the future.
Yeah, well, your website says Path to Freedom. You have an award-winning short film on YouTube called Homegrown Revolution. It sounds deep and political, social change. How does that come from growing your own food? Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, well, food being the essence of life, you can't get any more real than that. And we took back control of that. See, it had escaped us over the years by the generations. My parents let go of it, and then I was letting go of it when I was in college. I had no idea that I would want to, do this for a living, this is my life. And it also has now freed us from all the other political powers and corporate powers that are out there. We look at it as weaning ourselves back to a strong, self-reliant family, the way the nation was founded and how people became strong in the past. They were strong units, individually strong, and they formed a strong nation. So this is the real, politics of this is that the strength is in the individual growing their own and in a family situation growing their own food. It's like you become now a core, a cell that is very strong, and that you can build a strong units around that too. If you get a bunch of people doing the same thing.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze in just a couple more tips for people who want to do it. To get so much production from your city lot, you must be using vertical layering. Can you talk to us about some of the plants you grow and how they fit in with one another?
Okay. Yeah, well, certainly with such a small space, we have to take advantage of everything that we have. So we even grow produce down our driveway, down our fence line, in the front yard. We do a lot of use of arboring and trellising. So I mentioned before that we use fence lines are critical. Plants grow up. Some are vining plants. So we have a lot of grapes that give a shade at the same time that we had a good harvest of grapes. It's like it's a challenge to see if you can grow not just horizontally but vertically. Now, on a field, you get your choice of all the spaces that you want. But in the city, you have to look at it like, well, how about above here? So if you see a picture of my place, which we have a lot on the internet, and plus on Google, you can Google us, and see how we live. But a lot of it's in the vertical space. So I told you about the containers. We tucked containers in around, even in shady places. We can get some produce out of the shade. So we're using the whole lot, sides of the lot. You have to be able to determine where the plant grows best. So the best thing you can do is to have a mobile space. So sometimes the container gardens are your advantage. They're not limited to the ground, so you can kind of move them around and see where they thrive, see where they do best. And it's always an experiment like that.
Well, you raised the problem of global weirding, and I think there's two aspects of that I'd really love to get your expertise on. It. One is, how do you manage your garden during a heat wave so that it survives?
Wow, yeah, we had that. We're doing it right now, by the way. You know, this we've had hundreds just recently, and then what I try to do is I try to shade the plants so they don't get stressed by the heat. So what we'll do is we'll grow some tall plants that'll give a little bit of they like the heat. Like say tomatoes like the heat, and corn likes the heat, and some pole beans like the heat. And then behind it, just in a little nook behind it, I can grow some plants that need shade. They might need light, but they can't stand this blazing heat that they have. So we have to adjust it for shade. We can grow things in shade in a hot climate. So this is like a work in progress. We're always looking for ways to grow more, and one of the things to get out of the heat is to find a shading spot. Also, we have some shade cloth that we hang over beds every once in a while when it gets really, really tough out here. It'll cook the plants with the blazing sun, so we'll put a shade cloth on top of the beds.
Right, and another problem that can come up for other folks in other parts of the country is they think they're doing fine, but suddenly there's this really strong, gusty wind is threatening to blow everything down and everything over. Any ideas for that one?
Fortunately, we don't have that too much, except in the spring and in the fall. Most of the time, we don't have weather in the Southern California that's known as, kind of like no weather at all here, just hot or hotter. You know, that doesn't have much wind. So what we have, and we're in a city, so we don't get these, we have wind breaks. So it's not like living out in the country where the wind picks up over miles and miles and miles and can really cause you trouble. Yeah, I don't have the experience with the wind, but we do have block walls, fences around. And we do have our own windbreaks. I know in the open fields of the prairies and everything, they would plant trees as windbreaks to cut the force of the wind. You can tuck things around around the buildings. The building acts as a windbreak, pull them down.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Jules Gervais, a pioneer in developing a sustainable way of life in the city. Jules, what should listeners know if they hope to get a little extra income from surplus produce?
Okay, well, that would be great if you could do that. What I first would suggest is they grow what they needed for themselves. Like, if you grow what you like, first of all, and if you're fortunate enough to have some neighbors and some extended family, or maybe a church group, or at work that you belong to, you can start to get some of your produce into that arena by asking them if they would like to buy from you. So, we didn't have that situation here, so we went to the restaurants here in Southern California because there was a lot of restaurants. But if you're able to have neighbors that would buy from you, or your family, share the produce with your family, then definitely get them on board, and they'll love you for it, and they'll ask you for it, so you can almost be guaranteed that they'll want more. Then if you do better there, you can maybe go out and try a local small family type restaurant, no big chains, but you can see if they would want some of your fresh produce. And if you're in a area like we are, the trendy area, they love this stuff. I mean, this is, they can't keep enough of it on the shelves. This is the trend today, local, fresh, organic, and you can fetch a premium price. So what we do is we don't grow volume, but we grow enough small stuff, but that is so valuable that we can, raise the price on this, on the produce, that we call them heirloom specialty crops.
And as you know too well, in California, as the economy sours, literally millions of people are starting to think homegrown food is better than money in the bank. Tell us about the resources you offer on your website and maybe how to use them.
Okay, well, we have quite an extensive list of website sources that you can use. And then, of course, our film, Homegrown Revolution, that you mentioned, that's always inspirational to get everybody up and wanting to plant. The main one is urbanhomestead.org.
Certainly, if you start off at urbanhomestead.org, you're going to get somewhere. Jules Gervais, life keeps on changing. What is coming up for you and your family? Do you have some new projects in mind?
Well, right now, we have this problem. We've had too much compost, so we're just maxed out our place. We've got a mound of compost that is needs getting to, and we're trying to find more people that are in this area locally that want to share. We have a front porch farm stand that if they have produce, we can offer it as you know, exchange for something else. So we're kind of sharing our way of life on the front porch. And then the next thing would be for my grown children to actually do this themselves. So we're looking at a community of like-minded people that want to do the same lifestyle that we're living and maybe do it 365 days a year, 24/7 days a week. We're trying to change the way we live. And so the next step would be more like getting a community together.
And as we wrap up, is there any message you really want to leave with our listeners?
Oh yeah, I would say start something now, because you never know where it's gonna take you. Sometimes people maybe delay it; they might not have the perfect circumstance, and nobody does have it. So you have to start. That's first of all, and then stay with something. There's adversity along the way, and there's problems along the way, but you get to choose your problems. I mean, there's problems in the world, problems on the stock market. This way of life has problems too, but you stay with it, and hopefully you become smarter. And share with others. That's what we're looking for, is a spirit, a common spirit of sharing, like they did in the old days, the old spirit of, you know, it's the neighborliness and people helping each other, not waiting for an agency or a corporation or government or anything. It's more like self-reliance, and definitely go out and be in touch with your own family and then with your neighbors. So we're looking for everyone to start sharing.
It's always a pleasure to hear from leaders and innovators in any field. And when it comes to food self-sufficiency in the city, that is the Dervais family. There's Jules, Justin, Anais, Jordan. And to find out more, you can go to urbanhomestead.org. Jules Dervais, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, Alex, I enjoyed it. I hope to talk to you again. And I wish you well in everybody's and also everybody in their endeavors, too.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith at EcoShock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Every time there's a hurricane or a snowstorm, we see news footage of grocery store shelves going bare in a few hours of panicked buying. Our whole food system, from giant corporate farms to just-in-time truck deliveries, is shaky, very shaky. And so is the economy, really. Toss in GMO food, sugared-up corn syrup, and pesticides, and it's a public health mess. And then comes the drought, flood, heat waves, and freaky weather from climate change. All this yells at us. We should grow at least some of our own groceries. And Marjorie Wildcraft is the person to show us how. Her DVD course, Grow Your Own Groceries, sold over 300,000 copies. Her YouTube videos, the how-to videos, get tons of hits. Now she's organized a free online summit on homegrown food. Marjorie, I've been wanting to talk to you for 2 years. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. A couple of years back, Marjorie, I found out hot nights can stop vegetables from setting fruit, leaving a green garden, but no harvest. What are we going to do as the thermometer goes up with global warming?
That's definitely a big concern. And here's the thing. That's one of the reasons why we need to have more local regionalized varieties that are adapted to our region. A lot of times when you buy the seeds or the starts that you're getting, they are just the generic, you know, actually we've lost a lot of our seed heritage. We've lost, I think, some 95% of the heirloom varieties of seeds have disappeared in the last 100 years. And that's because we don't have a lot of local, we just don't have that network of small gardens and farms that we used to have. There's tons and tons of things that you can do, especially within just a few seasons, of breeding plants that are much more resilient in your particular local area. There's also a lot that you can do right now with existing cultivars, and I have a video on called Gardening in the Heat, and I'm going to tell you in particular the Gardening in the Heat one. Here in Texas, we get a summer full of it. So we had a summer here about 2 years ago where we had 30 days over 100 degrees. That was hot, and we still managed to get production on things.
It's a great video, and it's one of the reasons I found you, actually. I was asking myself that very question, what are we going to do? And I found your video, and it's a good one. As you know, Marjorie, the governor of California just issued mandatory water restrictions for the first time in that state's history. It's the drought.
What can the home gardener do to be prepared for dry times and water cutbacks?
Again, there is a tremendous amount that you can do, and water is of utmost concern. And especially at the Homegrown Food Summit, we have two experts talking about ways to do irrigation, and actually irrigation without buying a lot of tanks and pumps and things that you normally think of when you think of rainwater collection, but how are simple techniques that you can do just working with the land and shaping the land or using mulches or some of the other variety of techniques. But a future with less water is definitely what we're headed toward. Also, just growing your own food is going to help tremendously. The current commercial agricultural system uses an ungodly amount of water. It's just incredible. In fact, I believe that's the biggest use of fresh water on this planet is the commercial agricultural system. And the more that you grow your own food and get off of that, the more you're helping the overall big picture for the entire planet.
Well, many of us, especially in the U.S. Southwest, are going to hit dry times. But for other people, like British gardeners last year or New Englanders after Hurricane Irene, it's way too much water too fast. And I guess we can also prepare our gardens for extreme rainfall events.
That's true. I think the thing we need to prepare for instead is actually just much more wild vicissitudes in the climate. Peter Bain of the permaculture activist told me that I was probably living in the best place for it, because right here in Central Texas, we get that. Like in 1 year, we'll have 60 inches of rain. It'll be a deluge, and all my drought-tolerant plants that I had planted last year die, right? And then the next year we'll have only 12 inches of rain. And then, of course, anything that needs water dies. So learning to be more resilient is going to be the key.
You know, I don't think it's necessary that people believe in climate change or not. Extreme weather is happening. We can all see that. And then there's the economy. According to the government, everything's fine. There looks like there's lots of food in the supermarkets. So, Marjorie, why should we go to the trouble to plant our own food?
Well, that supermarket thing is a total illusion. Isn't it amazing? I mean, it looks, you go there and there's supermarkets, it looks, there's aisles and aisles and aisles of food. Really, all that food is based on about 12 different plants, believe it or not. Corn, wheat, and soy being the main three. And everything else is derived from that, and including your chicken and your dairy and your eggs. They're all really basically corn, wheat, and soy. And they're all just combined in this multitude of ways. Also, that food, there's only a 3 or 4 days worth of inventory at any given time in any locale in most of America. And it's all that vast interstate highway system that we have, that vast just-in-time trucking system delivers it to us. So anything interrupts that process, people are going to get hungry very, very fast. We've completely dismantled the small family farm network. I remember, you know, most of my life growing up and hearing Willie Nelson with the farm concerts that he used to put on, and I was always kind of wondering about them. Well, almost all those small farms died because they just couldn't compete against big commercial agriculture. Fortunately, we're seeing a resurgence of it, but it's going to take a long time to build those networks back. And the short story for you and I right now is there's not much food growing out in the countryside. Don't think that that's going to be available. If there's ever any kind of emergency, you're not going to be able to go head out and pick out some food from the countryside. It ain't there.
And meanwhile, the top 1% are raking off billions of dollars and the rest of us just get squeezed. That's going to get worse. I see a ready garden and the skills to plant as the only sure money in the bank. Do you feel that way with your family?
It's an activity that's a depression-proof activity, and that in terms of no matter what happens going forward with economic collapse or any type of pandemic or any type of event that causes a massive disturbance in the system, you'll be able to eat. But even if there aren't any changes, right now the commercial food supply is toxic. It is. You should not be eating that stuff. So growing your own food just makes a sense from a pure health perspective.
Marjorie Wildcraft, tell us about your experimental homestead. What does your place look like?
Well, we live in Central Texas, and we actually do have some acreage, but I actually don't use most of the acreage. The focus of my research center is how to come up with systems where you can grow half of your own food in your backyard size space in less than an hour a day. That's a pretty tall order. We've developed one system that works very well. And I've operated it for several years. So before I say something works, that means I've done it for quite a few years, because you can get lucky that first year, right? And we've developed one system with chickens and rabbits and a small garden. And I'll be presenting that at the Homegrown Food Summit. But we're also looking at all other types of things, aquaponics, hugelkultur, a vegetarian system, food forests. You know, what different ways can we do it in a small space and intensively grow more high-quality food for our families on an individual scale? That's what my home and my focus is all about.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the voice of homegrown food, Marjorie Wildcraft. You know, a fair number of presenters at that Homegrown Food Summit have been guests on Radio EcoShock. I ran into a bunch of them when I covered the Mother Earth News Fair in Washington State in 2013. I just have to mention John Kohler of Growing Your Own Greens. Like a few hundred thousand other people, I've watched and learned from dozens of his YouTube videos. Tell us what he does.
Oh, John is just such a lively and vibrant person. Yes, he is definitely an example. All of the speakers at the Homegrown Food Summit are really the world leaders in what's going on in backyard food production. And John focuses on people with suburban or urban-type situations, and specifically on sprouting and microgreens and small greens and getting started right away. That guy is amazing. He had, I believe, a terminal illness that he ended up realizing the medical system wasn't going to be able to help him, turned it around completely through basically growing his own food, and a lot of it had to do with eating a lot of fresh greens. And he's so fast, and he's so hyper and so excited all the time, and I was talking to him personally. I said, hey, John, do you drink a lot of coffee or what? And he says, no, it's just the good food. And he says, I don't actually drink coffee at all.
He packs a lot of stuff into one video. You really get your time worth out of it. And if you had to name one other favorite presenter, just tell us about one more from your online food summit.
One that really stunned me was Wonia Taibo, and she has a presentation on living without refrigeration. Wonia has been living without refrigeration for the past 10 years, and she just discusses all these different techniques. She says, you know, you really don't need that refrigerator. One of the biggest myths of living without a refrigerator is that you're going to waste a lot of food. She says, no, you actually waste a lot more having your refrigerator. I really liked that one.
All right, let's talk about you, Marjorie Wildcraft. How did you start out growing food? How did you learn?
Well, I started because I was a professional investor. I was actually a money manager, and I would create high-yielding limited partnerships for real estate investments. And through my passion and interest in money, I could see that the whole economy was eventually just going to collapse, that the whole thing was a house of cards. And we managed to dismantle all of our business before the real estate bubble collapsed in early 2000. And when I could see the consequences, I also started to become aware of peak oil and a whole bunch of other issues. And I said, you know what? I think that the most important thing going forward is going to be growing food. You know, I also got in touch with my anger at the destruction that we're doing to this planet. And I said, you know, fluorescent light bulbs and writing my senator and all that's very helpful, but you know what's going to have the most impact is me growing a significant part of my own food. I'll be saving water. I'll be building soil. I'll be being healthy for myself and my family. You know, the impact of you growing your own food is not only to your immediate body and your family, but it also really does directly impact the planet. So I started with a vengeance on learning everything I could about gardening and permaculture and food forests and livestock and hunting and primitive skills and any ways to eat and grow nutritious food.
And you keep an eye out for preppers and survival tips. Tell us about the Cubans you filmed who survived the crash there.
Because Cuba, the story with that is in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union came apart, all the satellite trading countries that they had been trading with just were suddenly cut off, and Cuba had sacrificed all their local sustainable agriculture for big monocrop production of sugar. That was their big product. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, I mean, overnight, they lost all of their oil imports and all of their food imports and textiles, machine parts, everything. They had been totally dependent on this international trade situation. Overnight, the buses stopped running, the electricity went out, and the average Cuban, within a very short period of time, lost 20 pounds. So I went there, and this was, you know, just a few years ago to interview the people who had lived through that crisis and what they had learned. A fascinating thing about it was they immediately all, before the government even had time to move on anything, people immediately started doing backyard food production, which is what people do in any type of crisis. And it was so reaffirming to me that all the techniques that we know of organic gardening and survival gardening, all the techniques that we know of worked for Cuba. They work everywhere. It was really a wonderful thing to see that.
Well, speaking of crashes, the Russians, who best survived the fall of the Soviet Union, were those who had their own kitchen gardens. The food system there was never that great. You had to line up so people knew how to grow things. Do you think America or Canada could experience a serious economic crash so that we would need our gardens?
I absolutely do. Yeah. I mean, that's the reason I completely got out of the business I was in. It's a mathematical certainty. The United States government right now is bankrupt. I mean, we've been bankrupt for years, and how it keeps staying afloat, I don't know. I am thanking God. I hope it stays afloat a little bit longer, because when the U.S. goes down, of course, it's going to be a global depression that happens on the earth. But yes, I feel that it's vital to be able to sustain yourself and your family. And again, even if it weren't that sort of force of concern about an economic collapse, the commercial food supply, you really should get off that as soon as possible.
And you were featured in National Geographic's hit show, Doomsday Preppers. What is the gardening prepper community like?
Well, you know, the prepper community are people that say, look, we see that there are tremendous changes coming. And it's always of interest. Some of them are preparing. They think a pandemic, some economic collapse, some worry about an electromagnetic pulse. You know, there's a variety of reasons. But all of them are saying, look, we know that there are tremendous changes coming. So it's a lot easier to make a change now and to choose it than it is to have a change forced upon you and to have it be sudden. And, you know, that community also tends to be kind of quiet, because you consider a doomsday prepper sort of paints you out as a weirdo or an oddball. And being a prepper means you're kind of standing out from the collective and saying, look, I think there's some problems. And a lot of other people don't want to face that reality. So there's a bit of a let's keep this all on the lowdown type of mentality in the prepper community, and probably for good reason. I personally have been told by people that if anything really bad happens, what they plan on doing is coming to my place with a gun. So, you know, I said, you know, that's really stupid to tell me ahead of time, because now I know I'm going to have to shoot you, right? Right? Whereas before, I probably would have worked with you.
Oh, my. Well, we hope it doesn't come to that. And sometimes in very hard times, like the Great Depression, people did work out not only a way to help themselves and each other, but the government actually came around to realizing we have a social role to play as opposed to cutting taxes for the wealthy. Now, Marjorie Wildcraft, you also talk about growing our own pharmaceuticals, and I know you don't just mean pot. Tell us about healing from our gardens.
You know, actually surprising. Well, I'm in Texas, and it's completely illegal here. And, boy, one thing you don't want to do is mess with Texas. So, yeah, I don't really deal with that particular medicine here. We take vacations in Colorado frequently. But, yeah, no, really, there's a lot of medicine. And there's the tyranny of the drugstore. You go to a drugstore, and what you're going to get are drugs. You think about it. You go to a drugstore, and you're looking for cough syrup. It's going to be a chemical mix. What I would really like is just some raw honey with, you know, some cloves and cinnamon in it or something, a really nice, you know, something for sore throats. There's tons and tons of things that are right in your backyard that will help you heal. Garlic. Probably one of the best antibiotics that we have available. Very easy to grow, very easy to use. It's far superior to any of the antibiotics that are ever prescribed when you go to one of those doc in a box or any other places. So, you know, more and more I depend on my own medicine.
Well, you know, we talked about eating processed food from factories, and it's killing people. And it's like we're sleepwalking zombies. We have people too obese to look after themselves, suffering from diseases that are obviously food-related, and yet people leave gardening to the last thing they will do about it. Why?
I don't know. You know, I am on a mission to turn growing food, people like equate it to migrant workers or something like that, but I am on a mission to let people know that growing food is powerful and sexy and fun. I mean, it's a positive feedback thing. Is the healthier you get, by the more you eat it, the more vibrant and alive you are, and the more connected you are with the planet itself. It's fantastic. I know there's that big hurdle, and you know, believe me, I know there's. Like, I've been doing this for years, and people would like to talk about the prepper and survivalist community. It's so much easier to go buy a gun and some bullets and feel like you're prepared, or buy a first aid kit, or buy a bag of beans and say, I'm prepared. That's not really preparation. Seems a lot easier that way, though.
Marjorie Wildcraft, thank you so much. And you can read all about Marjorie and this interview in my show blog on Wednesday at EcoShock. Be sure and join us next week for more science tips and disturbing news from Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. John Campbell, Coronavirus Update, and How Not to Treat a Coronavirus Fever. On March 23, 2020, as global confirmed corona cases top 400,000, Donald Trump stresses the need to reopen America and ease up on stay-at-home orders. At the same time, India announces a 21-day lockdown across the country, and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, after weeks of inaction, announces a strict lockdown all across England. Just before this news became public, Dr. John Campbell, in his daily update on his YouTube channel, explained how important the stay-at-home orders are. Dr. Campbell is a retired nurse teacher based in England. For a quarter century, he has taught nurses and lay people and healthcare workers in Asia and Africa. In 2007, he expanded to YouTube with his personal and casual approach and homemade slides and time-tested wisdom and ongoing research. He currently posts at Campbell Teaching on the spread of the coronavirus. This segment was posted hours before the UK and India were closed down. Dr. John Campbell.
Well, welcome everyone. It is Monday, the 23rd of March. Now, if I asked you to do some great heroic thing to save someone's life, like splash through the ice and take out a drowning child from the lake, or run into a burning house or something like that, a lot of you would do that because people naturally care for other people. When they see this immediate danger, they're very likely to respond positively. And you have that opportunity today. Today you can save a life. And for a lot of us, all we have to do is stay at home. Unless you're an essential worker, all you've got to do is stay at home, and that can save lives. No great hard thing, but by going out, you could be spreading infection and bringing people's lives into danger. So we're at the stage now where globally everyone needs to be 2 meters apart from each other. Now, in my country, for example, the United Kingdom, these measures have been announced for the past few days, and many people have been obeying it, but quite a few people haven't. So the government is probably going to have to bring out a legally enforced stay-at-home shutdown law, which is a pity, because there's nothing wrong with walking your dog outside or something, as long as you're on your own or with people who are in your house. But there's everything wrong with going on a crowded train or going to a market, a busy market. So it's a pity that people have not complied with this. They just don't seem to realise the importance of it. I've just told you how easy it is to save a life. Now, coming on to some important things for today and what it means. Now, I was listening to an interview this morning with Jerome Kim, Korean gentleman, American Korean, Director General of the International Vaccine Institute. So we can assume that this guy is a scientist and well-informed. He was saying we should know if a vaccine works in 12 months from now. So that is March 2021. He said approval could probably be fast-tracked in a few weeks after that. And 1 to 6 months after that, supplies would be available. So what this means is, realistically, we're looking at injecting vaccines into arms not before late summer 2021. Now, we're hopeful therapeutics will come out, but until then, all we've got is these non-pharmaceutical interventions. Everyone has their role to play. Absolutely everyone. In preventing the spread of this infection. In saving lives. We are in a stark situation all over the world now. So a number of official number of cases, official number of deaths, official number of recovered. Now, why is it that South Korea seems to have done so well? These numbers have been bobbing around here. Slight increase, of course. There was a cluster in Seoul last week, I think, at a call centre. But basically, South Korea has managed to level out the curve. This all-important curve. Because make no mistake, for Europe and the United States, this curve is going to carry on increasing. For the next week or more, we don't know. Depends on how effective our measures are. But the number of cases are going to increase. The number of deaths are going to increase. This is what's going to happen. The degree to which they increase and whether they eventually level off depends on the way that we all collectively behave to isolate ourselves from each other. So South Korea has been quite successful. So test, treat, isolate has been their strategy. And the massive amount of testing in South Korea has paid off. They can see their enemy. In the United Kingdom, we can't see our enemy because we don't have enough testing. Many free test centres were established in South Korea, so people knew if they were infected and would go home and self-isolate. Super spreaders could be identified. Cluster spreaders could be identified and then isolated, and those around about them quarantined. It was interesting, this guy was saying this morning, this Jerome Kim was saying, many companies in South Korea are led by scientists, and they made kits to test this at an early stage and had them validated. So quite a lot of scientific awareness in the business community in South Korea there, which probably led to some proactivity as regards testing kit preparation. And by and large, the population obeyed social distancing, unlike my country are not all doing at the moment, unfortunately. And again, China, some restrictions are being lifted in Wuhan at the moment. This was the very epicenter of the whole pandemic. They had 81,000 cases, which is more or less leveled off. And this number of deaths, about 4% of deaths. So again, their curves have gone down. The number of new cases are now well down. So these are, we would have to say, success stories. We need to learn from South Korea. We need the testing, we need the isolation, we need the quarantining, we need the education, we need the hygiene. We need all of these things. And we need to obey the social distancing. This is now a matter of life and death, and still people are going to markets and messing around buying silly things. We're in a war situation here. It's time to stop enjoying yourself outside for a period of time. Italy. The curve is still going up, and quite a few countries and quite a few areas in the United States are just a couple of weeks behind Italy. Distressing scenes from hospitals, of course. Death rate is absolutely horrendous. Now, we have looked at reasons for this in the past, and I'm going to be looking at a scientific paper about this later on today as soon as I get time, as to why the death rate in Italy is so high and what we can learn from that. But at the moment, I just want to mourn the tragic situation that is this death rate in Italy. Now, part of the reason here was, in contrast to South Korea, there was a lot of spread before the virus was detected. So basically, the virus had free reign in Italy for quite some period of time. Initially, we thought that there was serious cases in Italy because we were getting deaths at a fairly early stage. But actually, looking back, it's because the virus had already been spreading in the community and had built up this momentum. Just so much illustrating the need for proactivity. Italy's reacted dramatically, but they weren't aware of this spreading that was going on, resulting in a large amount of community spread. But now they've banned any movement inside the country and closed all non-essential businesses. So pretty well an economic and movement shutdown inside Italy. And given that people in my country and other countries, such as Germany, aren't fully complying with the voluntary lockdown. It's just a matter of time until there's legally enforced lockdowns in my country and Germany and other countries, I feel sure. Let's hope it's not necessary and there's a dramatic change in people's behaviours today, but we're going to see. So Germany, the death rate is incredibly low, and again, we've looked at reasons for that. It is encouraging, but I do expect the death rate in Germany to rise. I do expect the death rate in Italy to start falling as well, and we do expect the death rate to balance out at about round about the 1% mark, according to my chief medical officer. So we're still expecting that to be roughly where we're at, or going to be at the end of this pandemic. And it will end. Spain, a lot of new cases, a lot of new deaths. Indian curfew extended. India taking this really seriously. I've expressed my anxiety for India, Bangladesh, Pakistan before, and it's still there. Very fortunately, I think this is delaying things, but this is going to be hard to stop in India. Hong Kong ban on foreign arrivals and transit, and the governor, Carrie Lam, is trying to ban alcohol sales because she said it alters people's behaviour and makes physical contact more likely, which is true. So hopefully that will be passed in Hong Kong soon. And we had Dr. Tedros from the World Health Organization yesterday telling us to cut down on alcohol anyway to boost our immune systems. So that message remains in place. If you're drinking alcohol, cut back as much as you possibly can, and actually ideally stop for a period of time. And of course, if you're smoking, I think you understand the importance of stopping. New Zealand, 102 cases, probably more than that in reality. Non-essential businesses and schools have to close. Prime Minister Ardern, the worst case scenario is simply intolerable. It would represent the greatest loss of New Zealanders' lives in our history, and I will not take that chance. And of course, the famous Anzacs in the First and Second World War suffered horrendous losses, and it looks like it could be worse than that if the non-pharmaceutical interventions are not taken seriously, but it seems they are, and New Zealand is getting on top of that. South America is not too many cases in South America. Brazil is a bit of an exception, quite a few cases in Brazil. But South America on the whole being very proactive and instigating large-scale national measures, which is encouraging to see. And there is no doubt in my mind at all that will significantly slow the spread of the virus down, giving a lot more time to prepare. Now, my apologies to all Colombians yesterday. I mispronounced your country. It's Colombia, not that's not a U, it's an O. but the reason I put it on is not so much the amount of cases, but the civil unrest was very concerning. 23 deaths in prisons. These aren't deaths from the virus. These are deaths through violent unrest. So concerning. My concern for institutions remain. But very glad to see the proactivity taking place all over Latin South America. Now, the United States has come to the party a bit late with its interventions, but it is coming now. A lot of cases, current death rates 1.2% in the United States on the official figures. But of course, testing is only just getting going in the States. But when greater numbers of people are diagnosed, that can bring that percentage down. But then, of course, some deaths have occurred from COVID-19 that haven't been recognised as deaths from COVID-19, which would tend to increase that. New York is actually running short of some aspects of medical equipment. The National Guard is being deployed in New York, California, Washington State to set up large-scale, military-style medical stations, basically large mobile hospitals. Ohio, Louisiana, Delaware, broad restrictions. But basically, this is going to have to apply to all of the United States. We have to accept that life is going to change for some weeks into the future, if not months into the future. We'll get through it, but this is not a time for normal behaviour. We want much better behaviour than normal. Now, the United Kingdom, cases increase. Our testing has become quite lamentable in this country. We don't have the testing facilities. We don't have the personal protective equipment to look after those people that are doing the testing. We've been promised an antibody test, and that cannot come soon enough. Hopefully, that will just be a prick of blood that people can basically do at home on their own, and we'll know if they've had the infection. So under-testing, under-reporting in my country, unfortunately. Now, just before we finish today, just a little bit of epidemiology here. Number of new cases in the population at risk is the attack rate. Now, what this is going to be, we don't really know. Globally, it could be anywhere between 50 and 80%. It could well be, in many areas, it could be 50% over the next 12 months. It is possible. I'm just hoping the social isolation distancing measures keep that well down. Because 2021, when we should get this vaccine, and the problem will be sorted when we get the vaccine. We need the vaccine, but we haven't got it yet. So the attack rate, it could well be that more than half the world's population are going to get this COVID-19 infection. Let's hope that's a pessimistic estimate and that the huge scale changes that we are seeing now are effective and the number is massively less than that. Now, the people at a particular risk, this is the data from China. So the Chinese studied the first 72,000 cases that were registered here and produced this paper, The Epidemiological Characteristics of an Outbreak. Now, their case fatality rate was higher in men than women. And the fatality rate did increase with age, but today there's been some alarming reports from the UK of younger people who are really quite ill with this disease. So it's not that simple, but these have been recognised as figures. This may be due to great amounts of male smoking in China. That's not entirely clear yet. Now, the death rate in people with significant established cardiovascular disease was 13.2%. Diabetes, presumably that depends on the degree of control. I believe diabetes is very common in China, 9.2%. Again, significant chronic respiratory disease, the death rate was 8%. This is in people that got the infection. This was the case fatality rate, hypertension, cancers. And of course, anyone that's immunocompromised is going to be at risk. And I've recently expressed my grave concerns about people with underlying HIV infections as well. And this was the age profile of death rates in China. Younger age groups, the death rate was 0.2% case fatality rate. As we got older, the case fatality rate increases. So someone 80 plus who got COVID-19 infection had a nearly 15% chance of dying. 70 to 79, an 8% chance. 60 to 69, 3.6% chance, and going down with younger people. But as I've said, we are already seeing significant cases in younger people in the UK. So these are only indicators of what happened in the Chinese situation. I would expect the overall cases in the UK to follow a similar pattern, but as of now, we don't know. This is a novel virus. There's still so much we are still learning.
That was Dr. John Campbell's daily update for March 23rd, 2020, with a gentle reminder that COVID-19 is not just a disease for elders. Dr. Campbell's YouTube comments, often more than one a day, cover the public health aspect of the corona epidemic, and he gives specific advice on the behavior of the virus and how treatment might affect it, all the while saying that he's not our doctor. The following commentary deals with the treatment of fever. Since fever has become the most important first-line diagnostic indicator of a COVID-19 infection, it may be frightening for anybody to discover that we're running a temperature. Many might react by searching for a pharmaceutical to bring the fever down. Dr. Campbell says that could be the wrong thing to do. Here are his comments on specific advice given by the French Minister of Health, Olivier Véran. Here's Dr. Campbell.
Well, good morning, and you are most welcome as always. Now, it's Monday the 16th of March, and I want to start off today with what is a very important announcement that I believe has the potential to save many, many lives. Now, for a long time, I've been teaching that fever is a natural adaptive response. When people have a fever, the viruses do not replicate quickly, as quickly as they normally would. And that's the same for viral infections and bacterial infections. And also, when someone has a fever, the immune system is going to be stimulated by that fever and is going to combat any infection more effectively. So what I'm saying basically, I'm talking about adults here, is that fever is generally a protective mechanism. It's good to have a fever when you're sick. It makes you feel absolutely awful, but it's helping you combat the infection. Now, I've been a bit reluctant to go down this path in the past, but evidence now is starting to accumulate. So the French health minister, who is also a doctor, a neurologist who specializes in neurological conditions. So this is a French official, himself a neurologist. Right, the taking of anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen and cortisol could be a factor in aggravating the infection. Right, there we have a simple statement. I agree with it 100%. Now, what he's talking about here is anti-inflammatory drugs. Now, there's two types of anti-inflammatory drugs that I'm aware of. There are steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and there are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So, inflammation is the body's response to injury and infection and insult. And we can reduce inflammation sometimes when we need to, because that's clinically important. And sometimes it's clinically important to do that. And to do that, we can use steroid drugs, which are strong drugs, which are similar to a hormone produced by the body. Corticosteroid drugs produced by the adrenal cortex, or same as hormones produced by the adrenal cortex. That doesn't matter. So that the steroid or cortisol type drugs, they're the strong steroid type drugs. And in the UK, certainly, they're only available on prescription. But then there's this whole other group of drugs called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NASIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And they are anti-inflammatory. They're not as anti-inflammatory as quickly as steroids or as profoundly as steroids, but they're still anti-inflammatory. And they're available over the counter. This is the issue. So what we're saying is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NASIDs, are probably going to make the infection worse with COVID-19. And every home will have this. If you look in your medicine cabinet at home, I'm sure you've got some. Now, these drugs, what are they? Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, what are they? Aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, and there are a couple of trade names that you get for ibuprofen, sometimes called brufen in this country. So what you need to do is look at the medicine that you're considering taking, and on the packet it should say if it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, and if it's any of these, then it's looking like the French authorities are saying don't take these drugs, and I agree. Now, I am not your doctor. I cannot tell you what drugs to take and what not to take. But if I had this infection, there is absolutely no way on this earth I would be taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug to bring the fever down. Absolutely no way at all. Or anyone I was responsible for, I would strongly advocate against in my own care or looking after family members or whatever. I would strongly advocate against taking any non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug if someone has a fever caused by COVID-19. Now, this chap here, head of pharmacology at Toulouse Hospital, again, French authority. Just mark these words well. Anti-inflammatory drugs increase the risk of complications when there is a fever or infection. So if you want to get more complications, take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. If you don't want to get more complications, this advice is do not take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or indeed any other anti-inflammatory drugs. Now, some people are on the strong anti-inflammatory drugs called steroids because their doctor has told them to. So, for example, in this country, we commonly give one called prednisolone for asthma, or we sometimes use it for other inflammatory conditions such as polymyalgia and other inflammatory disorders. Now, if you're taking prednisolone, I would not give you any advice whatsoever. Let me make that clear. You must call your doctor to ask for advice on that. But if you are taking that medicine, the data coming out of France here is showing that it could be associated with complications. And certainly the over-the-counter non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs, these people are advising against, and I agree with them 100%. Now, the French authorities are saying paracetamol should be taken if you have a fever. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this. Not by any means am I saying I agree with this, because we've just talked about the fact that fever is an adaptive response. So I'm not telling you what drugs to take or what drugs not to take. I'm not your doctor. But when I have a fever, I try not to take paracetamol because I'm an adult. If I've got a fever of 39 degrees centigrade, I'm going to feel absolutely awful. 39.5, even hotter than that. I'm going to feel absolutely awful. But I know that my immune system is working better because I'm at that fever temperature. I know that my body has increased that fever temperature quite deliberately. It's not an evolutionary or pathophysiological mistake. It's common to many animals who also get fevers if they have infections, indicating that it's been around for an awful long period of time, this febrile adaptive response. So what these French doctors are saying, that if you've got a fever, don't take non-steroidals, but you can take paracetamol, which goes by the name of acetaminophen in the States. Sometimes we call it Panadol in England, Tylenol, whatever you want. Tylenol is the common name in the States. It reduces fever, but it's not anti-inflammatory. So look at what medicine you are taking. Now, with paracetamol, of course, it's very toxic if you take too much. So you've got to carefully follow the correct dose. So the French authorities are saying, if you've got a fever, don't take the non-steroidals. But if you've got a fever, consider taking paracetamol. My understanding of the theory is that your immune system works best at febrile temperatures. Therefore, I would avoid taking paracetamol, even though it means you feel pretty bad for a period of time. That's what I do. Again, I have to cover myself in these videos. I would advise you to call your own doctor for advice. But there's no question at all in my mind that the immune system is working better, that the viruses are much more uncomfortable when we are at febrile temperatures. If people all around the world are taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are so readily available, evidence is starting to accumulate that that is going to increase the rate of complications. And of course, one of the complications of COVID-19 disease, coronavirus disease 2019, one of the complications is death.
That was Dr. John Campbell. He recorded himself at his home in Northern England on March 16, 2020. And I'm presenting his advice on fever here while most of us are still cool-headed enough to talk to doctors or nurses to know what's best for us when we experience fever. I want to credit Dr. Campbell's daily friendly and learned and low-tech commentaries on the corona epidemic on his YouTube channel, Campbell Teaching. That's C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L, Teaching. One word. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.